to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing and reversing the aging process. We're going to talk about what stress does that we don't want, why you should be very careful about the drinking water coming out of your tap, the best foods for calming your nervous system. And these are easy to obtain and inexpensive and for everyone. Fruits and veggies, they make you more optimistic. Well, how do they do that? And the 10 best sources of the omega-3 fatty acids, which seem to confuse a lot of people. Many people have been told that it is only with the fish oil that you can get your omega-3s. Not true. I'll give you the high-quality omega-3 and DHA fish oils, or non-fish oils, on today's program. Also, time permitting, a commentary from Glenn Greenwald, The Untouchables, How the Obama Administration Protected Wall Street from Prosecutions. A lot on the environment, including what's going to be happening to cities on the East Coast, all about the melting glaciers and what it's doing in South America. And then I will get to some piece of this, and I'm going to ask you to call in and share your points of view. I believe that we should start a national movement to ban trading in commodities essential to life. Now, many people will say that that interferes in free market principles, and I say it interferes in people's ability to live. I believe that we should not be sitting on $1,000 trillion derivative bubble. I don't believe that we should allow people to manipulate the prices of foods for their own profit. I believe that water is essential to life and therefore should not be allowed to be commodified as it is now. So the taking the profit out of commodities essential to all of us will be a discussion. I'll give you one example of what happens when you don't. I have two guests today. One is a newsmaker. John Rappaport is back, and I'm going to ask him one question only. What happened when an insider contacted you to tell you the truth of what he and others that he worked with were doing to destroy the reputation of people such as Peter Duisberg, who were challenging the HIV equals AIDS equals death equation? I had a similar experience. I'll be interested to hear from him. I have not spoken with him on this, but I know that a very important person within the pharmaceutical industry was behind all this. He'll tell us what he knows. This will be an exclusive interview, but it's a newsmaker one, a short one, about 10 minutes. Then for a longer interview from Cambridge University, Melanie Challenger. She is one of the most important British environmental writers. She works at Cambridge University's Institute of Astronomy. And in fact, she was the artist in residence for the British Antarctic Survey. And her work focuses upon cultural biodiversity and the impact of industrial society upon cultures and ecological endangerment and extinction. She's the author of On Extinction, How We Became Estranged from Nature. Our conversation will focus upon extinction, and how we have become so estranged, and why we don't pay attention to what's no longer with us, or shortly will not exist. Topics that are not discussed in most of the media, and this is the forum for those, because progressive minds tend to be more educated, looking at life with a little more serious perspective. Doesn't mean that they don't have joy and happiness and fun and frivolities. We all do. But they know how to put what's important in front of them. Also, for those of you who've been listening over the telephone, the last couple of days, the phone has been staticky and the volume off. And so we spoke with a company, and they have changed the number to now there is a clearer signal. Now, this is important when you consider that there's tens of thousands of people spending over 3.3 million minutes listening to this program. And therefore, it's important that it's number one in all the northern and southern hemisphere, and only second in the world out of 4,000 that use the service. It's not a toll-free. You pay whatever your normal, carrier charges. But boy, it's a great service, because this means that no longer do you have to be sitting by a radio to hear this program, or sitting in a car, so many do at lunch hour. I can't tell you how many thousands of people. So every lunch hour I go out and I sit in the car and I listen to the show. Now you can listen anywhere where you have a radio. And with all the small radios, you can just put it on speaker, put in the earphones and listen. And you can even go to the archives and listen if you forget something. I just recently spoke with a person in an airport. I'm on the road and I'm traveling and filming, and a person came over to me and we had a long conversation. About an hour, I was waiting on a flight that was delayed, and this person was on the same flight. And the person said that this fellow's in economics and finance, and said that he spends his time driving with his wife to the country, putting on the archives and listening to shows that he has missed. Here is the new number, 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. Now, if you didn't get it, you call the old number. It has a recording that leads you to this number. Let's begin. We have a lot to share today. I counseled a person yesterday who is suffering from a very serious physical condition. It's life-threatening. And this is a, by any measure, what would seem to be an easygoing guy, laid back, carefree, kind of like an adult hippie. But he developed his own businesses and was very successful at it, and married and adopted some kids. And ideally, he would look like he has an ideal life. But then why did he get this cancer? And why didn't anyone pay attention? And he said to me, he said, Gary, I know why I got the cancer. And I said, why? He said, stress. He said, about 4 years ago, I had some issues in my life, financial issues and others, that I couldn't handle. I was under enormous pressure. I wasn't getting help. And I felt rage and anger all the time. I didn't show it. I kept the nice, jovial face on for friends and family and business people. But I can tell you, I was one unhappy dude all the time. And when I got the cancer, everyone was surprised, because I hadn't drank, hadn't smoked, and exercised, ran 6 miles a day. And then I watched a video that someone sent me. It's a long video, hours, about that you did called stress. And then in it, you're laying out how the biochemistry of stress, like cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, adrenaline, how these in turn can be kept on all the time. Anytime you're anxious, anytime you're depressed, anytime that you suffer from any form of anxiety, unrequited situation, you're going to have these hormones on. So you adapt to them. And he said that he adapted by being busy all the time, always active. But he noticed other people who are also very anxious, would eat, some drink, some take drugs. Everybody selected the different way to deal with it. And he said, now I know that my protocol you gave me is only going to work if I de-stress. And he said, so I can tell you something. I put everything in my life on hold. When you did the video saying, drop all the balls in your life, just let them fall. Because you've got to focus upon the essentialness of you, the importance of you. And he said, I never appreciated what that meant. It was just some words. He said, now I realize that if I die, yeah, I've left my kids a nice death policy that they'll won't have to worry. But that's not what I want. I want to get through this. I want to live. but I've got to surrender a lot of stuff, and I've got to deal with stress. So now the good news is he's dealing with stress. This is the latest from today. Stress taxes your biological functions in a number of ways, with one study finding that it may even play a role in the development of breast cancer. The autonomic nervous system helps to regulate respiration, heart rate, and other internal body functions. Psychosocial stress, such as fear and anxiety, negativity, impact the autonomic nervous system, which could explain the link. Breast, prostate, and ovary glands, as well as other tissues in the body, from radioactive iodine, whether used by mad doctors or ingested from the environment, all impact it, but stress also does. Therefore, the more stressed we are, the more susceptible our immune system is to developing cancer. And that's the latest on that. I don't drink unfiltered tap water. I know what's in tap water. I've analyzed tap water time and time again. And you don't look for turbidity. You don't look for the kind of the off-colorness, little particulate matters. That's very obvious. Most tap water doesn't have that because they'll use chlorine. So the assumption is if my water's chlorinated, that's good because then that killed all the bacteria and got rid of everything bad. My water's clear. Look, see this glass? Not true. You could have hundreds of chemicals in your water and it still be clear that were not affected at all by chlorine. For example, nanoparticles of medicines, everything from chemotherapy and AZT and heart med, statins, tranquilizers, they can all come right through any water filtration system that municipalities use. Also, a lot of parasites can get through. Here's the latest. This is from Globalist Report, written by Lawrence Laban. Quote, chlorine has long been added to tap water in many communities to ensure it is free of bugs and bacteria. The chemical is also found in many other household items, as well as in pesticides that are often used to treat produce. New research from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, New York, has now found evidence that the use of chlorine is associated with a rising number of people with food allergies. Researchers have found adults with high levels of a chemical, which is a dichlorophenol, a byproduct of chlorine, in their urine, were as much as 80% more likely to also have food allergies. That's a shocking find, especially when upwards of 15 million Americans suffer from food allergies. Lead author, Dr. Jurchow, professor of allergy and immunology at Einstein, said the research, quote, shows that high levels of dichlorophenol containing pesticides can possibly weaken food tolerance in some people, causing food allergy. So one more reason not to drink chlorinated tap water. Get rid of the chlorine, get a filter, and that will help you. Now, I get a lot of calls of people saying, what do we do? It's the flu season. Is there anything special that we could use that might help us? Yeah, I've gone over that numerous times, what you can bring into your system that would be good for you. There's no shortage. Vitamin D3 is one of the best things you can do. But there are other things as well. And vitamin C, quercetin, Podiarco, astragalus, echinacea, olive leaf extract, colloidal silver, all good. And that's why many of us, I believe, don't ever get a cold or flu, because we keep our immune system strong. But let me tell you one of the things I also do. I always have with me something that my great aunt gave me. She was an archaeologist. Every time she came back, she'd give me a stone from somewhere in the world. She was my great uncle's sister. And she, anytime someone started to get sick, my mother would rub a Vicks a rub on her chest and throat. That certainly helped, and stunk. But she would say, well, there's something better to do. And she'd whip out this bottle and she'd have us drink a quarter of a cup of it. Tasting pretty good. And we'd always get better. Later, when I asked her what was that, she said, "Oh, that's elderberry." And I said, "Elderberry? Yeah." She said, "It's good for just about everything, and I take it with me everywhere." I believe that we should be using elderberry every day during this time of year. It is a natural form of flu fighter, and I don't know of anything that can really top it. It's got a lot of different things that it can do, and specifically for flu. It's actually in the scientific literature. See, black elderberry extract, or Sambucocus nigra, or what is called Sambucol, S-A-M-B-U-C-O-L, it's very powerful. It's all natural. It's just black elderberry extract, and it has very strong antiviral properties. And that means it's good against different strains of influenza virus. So the Sambucol has been shown to be effective in vitro against 10 strains of influenza virus. There was even a double-blind, placebo-controlled randomized study, and it reduced the duration of flu and symptoms by 4 days. So, easy to use. It's an ancient panacea, by the way. It's been around. The medicinal use of elderberry goes way back. The little berry has been used since 400 B.C. In fact, Hippocrates referred to the elderberry bush as the medicine chest because of its varied uses. And it's Pliny the Elder used it. In the ancient Roman times. So try it. You know, it's a natural remedy. It's inexpensive. It's very effective. And just get the organic, a pure, undiluted. It tastes good, too. You'll like it. So another thing that can help us. Now, here are the best foods for calming your nervous system. Sweet potatoes and yams. Now, these are complex carbohydrates. They don't spike your blood sugar level, but they're very rich in vitamin A and vitamin C. And they can help calm the nerves. They can lower blood pressure. They contain an array of compounds. They feed your glandular system. They help with your urinary and nervous systems. So you can make a sweet potato or yam smoothie. How do you do that? It's simple. You simply steam the yam or sweet potato. Always wash it first, and you steam it until it's soft. You can put a fork in it, and it goes in easily. Then take off the outer skin, and then throw that into a blender. Then you could, if you talk about something really good, you could then add some elderberry to that. That would be a real kick. And also, you can add in there some marshmallow, which is an herb, anise, which is really cool, it tastes like licorice, fennel, and cinnamon. And then add your liquid, whatever you choose, rice milk, almond milk, soy milk, and blend that up. Now, for someone who has an upset stomach or nervous stomach, or someone who's just nervous, it's a great calmative. But also, you could do the same thing with bananas. Now, most of the time we think of bananas because it's rich in potassium, and it has some electrolytes, so it helps the body stay hydrated. But bananas also contain magnesium and B6 that help boost the production of digesting-enhancing mucus. And that, in turn, helps the body better digest food, and it also helps aid the production of serotonin and melatonin. Both hormones regulate mood and sleeping patterns and promote muscle relaxation and reduce stress. In the Orient, they use green tea, or white tea, or pink tea. They're all rich in an amino acid called L-theanine. Thea, T-H-E-A-A, 9-N-I-N-E, theanine. That enhances mood by stimulating the production of alpha waves in the brain. It also reduces stress and allows you to relax. So, theanine from green tea very relaxing. And if you put in a little Manuka honey, then, and by the way, put in a little bit of elderberry. Never drink tea hot. Never drink any beverage hot. Drink it lukewarm. And then put some elderberry, so you're not only stimulating relaxation with decaffeinated green tea, but you're also helping prevent the flu and stimulating your immune system. Dark chocolate, dark cocoa, it's great. It contains L-tryptophan, and that's a neurotransmitter, and that helps the brain relax. It calms down the system. It contains magnesium that calms us down, and it's important for our nervous system. So that's good. So have yourself a little, let's say, dark chocolate, or even, how about this? Why not have some chocolate milk? Make yourself a warm, not hot, glass of milk from almond, rice milk. Put in some raw, unsweetened cocoa, and now you got the ticket. Remember, chocolate contains a neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter is very important because it has the ability to alter dopamine levels in the brain, causing a sense of peace and relaxation. And then you have also tryptophan in chocolate. That's a precursor to serotonin, which plays a role in relieving stress and allowing calmness. Then Brazil nuts. It's one of the best ways of getting our selenium, and it's really the relaxing nut to the nervous system. There was a University of Wales study that showed that eating just 3 little Brazil nuts daily could boost mood and promote feelings of calm and ease anxiety in just 3 months. And the vegetable that would help you keep calm would be spinach. Spinach is good because of, again, the phytonutrients it contains, including vitamin K, and which is one of the best sources of vitamin K, but also spinach helps regulate the production of hormones in the nervous system, and that improves mood and sleep. So, things you can do to keep yourself healthy and relieve stress. Now, I also, fruits and vegetables make you more optimistic. This is from the Times of India, quote, "People who prefer to eat fruit and vegetables are likely to be more optimistic thanks to higher levels of plant compounds called carotenoids in the blood. Previous studies have shown that high blood levels of antioxidants, of which carotenoids are one form, make people happier." And then it goes into why it doesn't, how it doesn't. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Psychosomatic Medicine. And finally, I mentioned I would share the top sources of the omega-3 fatty acids. Well, flaxseed is, in my opinion, your best. It is rich in the, and if it's raw and organic, of course, it can be used as a laxative, it can lower cholesterol, can fight heart disease. It's very rich in the omega-3 alpha-linolenic acid, or the LA, and this acid helps your body to convert ALA into EPA and DHA. And to protect the omega-3 fatty acids in the flaxseed, always store it in the refrigerator. Then the omega-3 fatty acids, good source is chia seeds. Chia, C-H-I-A, it's a plant, and it is very gelatinous. When you add any liquid, it gels up. Very good way to expand the nutrient value of any of the juices or smoothies you're making. Then salmon, wild salmon, that is a rich source of the omega-3 fatty acid for those who are going to get it from fish. Then you have, separate from salmon, but less efficient, would be fish oil in general, and other than salmon. And then walnuts. Walnuts are delicious, nutritious, lots of omega-3 fatty acids, also some good fiber, protein, and iron. Soybeans are very good, and soy milk is also good for the omega-3 fatty acids. In fact, a small cup of soy milk generally will handle most people's daily needs. Then eggs, for those who eat eggs, cauliflower, organic canola oil, unprocessed, and spinach. Those are your best sources of the omega-3 fatty acids, your top 10. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our first newsmaker. He's on hold now, so we're not going to take a break. We're going to go right over and say hello to John Rapoport. John is an investigative reporter for over 30 years. He focuses upon writing about politics and the corporatocracy, alternative health, and medical cartels. And he's written for Spin and Stern and Village Voice and many other organizations. And he's written books. And his website is nomorefakenews.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here, Gary. Thank you.
John, one question only for you today. You've written so much and you've done so much. I want to have you back for just single topics where I ask you a question and you do a newsmaker and you roll with it. Here's today's topic. A little context. I was approached one day after leaving WBAI by a very large man. It was the middle of August, and he came over to me. He was bald-headed. He had a convertible car there, and he said, "Are you Gary Noll?" I said, "Yes." He said, I have something I want to share with you." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Can you come to the car?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to your car." And so I said, "Pull around the corner." Well, there was a police station around the corner, so we literally pulled right in front of the police station. Then I felt comfortable getting in his car because he couldn't do anything. And so I sat there, and he told me a story, and he told me a story that was so incredulous that immediately I would have dismissed him as a nut, except he told me things that no one, and I mean no one, knew. He started off by saying, "You don't know who I am, and you'll never see me again. This will be the one and only time we have a conversation." And I interrupt and said, "Why? Why do you want to speak with me?" And he said, "Because I feel guilty. I've been following you for over a year and a half. I'm a part of the Noll team." And I said, "What's the Noll team?" "A group of individuals who have looked for weaknesses, anything that we can use to scandalize you, to blackmail you. But these guys are serious. And each one of your books and each one of your national appearances is hurting them. And you're the number one person out there. You're as bad to them as Ralph Nader was to other industries. And they're not going to take it. So I just want to let you know that they're going to ratchet it up and it's going to get serious. And they may whack you. They may kill you." I said, "Yeah. So tell me the story." But he told me of situations where I'd met people, contracts I had signed but were canceled last moment, a network television series that was canceled after four shows that never went on the air. And all these things that no one knew about because I'd never spoken about any of this to the public. And so then I realized he was telling me the truth. He even mentioned, he said, "Do you remember Jerry Rubin's 50th birthday party?" I said, "Yeah, I wasn't there." He said, "Do you remember there was a woman out on the balcony who just casually said, 'Hi, what's your name? What you here for?' Do you remember her name?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Was it this?" And he told me the name. I said, "Yes. She was one of the plants." And then he went into detail about what she intended to do. Now, fortunately, I had only had dinner with this woman, nothing more. And he said, "Did a guy come to you saying that he worked for the Village Voice and wanted to help the cause and was going to volunteer some time?" I said, "Yes." "Did you ever check the Village Voice or check his address?" I said, "No." "Why don't you do that? He was also a plant. All around you, they put plants." And then he told me something that had happened that no one knew. That someone had tampered with one of my manuscripts at the printer and substituted milligrams for micrograms. And only at the last moment did I catch it, and we stamped all the copies to correct it. But that was so frightening, because how does someone get into a printing plant and go over the blues, and that's the last copy before it's printed? So then he had my full and undivided attention. He went on to tell me about how they operated and why me, because I was the only one who had crossover bestsellers, and I had like 11 straight bestsellers in a row. I was on national television every week, and he said, "And they're not going to allow it to continue. So look for ways of destroying your reputation." And he also said, "Do you think WPI doesn't have provocateurs and infiltrators? I said, don't know. He said, well, and he went on. I won't say what he said. That remains confidential because I won't give anyone any ideas. But after that, I went back, and sure enough, the guy who was working with us, when we looked, he didn't ever work at the Village Voice, and his home address was non-existent. We had to shred over a million documents because we didn't know what misinformation he had planted. But I was told he planted misinformation. So when we wrote an article or a book, my brother, Stephen Howard, there'd be misinformation that we could then be criticized for. That's enough about me.
Well,
now you. You were approached by a man who came from inside the AIDS pharmaceutical, I'm assuming pharmaceutical establishment, because there's no other establishment would have the interest to do something similar, someone who is going to tell you the truth. And when I asked this man, why are you telling me this? He said, because after a year and a half of following you and looking into every aspect of your life, going to your hometown and asking friends, Gary, ever do drugs? You ever did blah, blah? Nothing. You know, you were a Boy Scout. You have nothing we can nail you on because we've tried. Now, tell us the story that no one's heard. You're going to let our audience know, because I want this audience to know how down and dirty the people who are pro the HIV equals AIDS hypothesis get, and how they go about discrediting some of the greatest minds in the world, like Peter Duisberg, or the Nobel Prize winner Kary Mullis, or Dr. David Rasnick, and others who had the courage to look for the truth and found it. I'm really concerned that the audience knows the truth. The form is yours. Take your time.
Okay, Gary, thank you. That's quite a story. Back in 1987, I was writing my first book called AIDS, Inc. And about 4 or 5 months into the research, I had really no idea where I was going with it. I just knew, had an instinct that there was something there. I came across Peter Duisberg's journal article, March 1, 1987, in Cancer Research, that indicated there was no reason to believe that HIV was the cause of AIDS. Somewhere in the writing of the book, through a friend, I met a man who started to tell me that he had experience with, how can I put this, making certain medical lies into medical truth, that he was a propaganda operative. And he told me a few little stories and so on. And I was very interested, but still didn't quite see the connection. We lost touch. But a few years later, he came back into the picture, and he said, okay, you've written the book now. You understand a lot more. He said, I'm retired. I'm not in the game anymore, because it occurred to me at some point that it was just too debilitating to myself, meaning himself, to be in that game of lying, lying, lying. And he wanted to talk to somebody, and he thought I might be the right person if I was willing to be completely off the record. I said, sure, why not? Let's see what happens. He used the pseudonym of Ellis Medavoy. And I said, well, I'm going to have to do everything I can to check you out to see if you are who you say you are. And he said, I understand that. And I spent a lot of time. It was very difficult. But I satisfied myself in the end that this guy was real and that what he was saying was very real. He never did tell me exactly who he was working for, and he refused to do that. But it was fairly obvious from what he was talking about that he had taken on contracts as an independent operator, so to speak, from certain people within the core of the Council on Foreign Relations, a very well-known globalist group that's existed since 1920-21 in New York, headed up by the Rockefeller family, and that also somewhere along the line, big pharma interests were involved. And he said basically this to me. We had to discredit the people who were saying that HIV was not the cause of AIDS. because, number one, it was extremely damaging to pharmaceutical interests who were producing the drugs to treat HIV, and it was also politically very uncomfortable because there was a whole scenario operating on the basis that HIV did cause AIDS in the third world. I said, what do you mean about the third world? He said, well, look, HIV is a smokescreen for death and destruction in the third world, which has been going on forever, Latin America, Africa, so on. The basic causes of diseases in those areas have been the same forever, and you wrote about it in your book, so you understand that. We're talking about contaminated water supplies, generation to generation hunger and starvation, protein calorie malnutrition, lack of basic sanitation, overcrowding in cities, the outright theft of agricultural lands that were traditionally used by the people to grow their own food. This is what kills people. The political program of, and he didn't specify, but obviously major corporate and government interests, is to keep that going, to keep going death and dying in the third world from the causes that have made it so forever. But we have an ideal opportunity for a smokescreen here to obscure the whole thing and make sure that these problems are never remedied, because the leaders, dictators in the third world, and the outside corporate and government interests want to maintain a very weak, debilitated, confused, dying population because they're easier to control.
But bring it back to Peter Duisberg. That's where I want you just to focus.
Yeah, well, what he said was, look, here's where Duisberg doesn't even know the harm that he's causing, because when he says that HIV is not the cause of AIDS, couldn't be the cause of AIDS, is ridiculous as the cause of AIDS, he's absolutely right. And we know that. He said that outright to me, Metaboy. He said, we know that. It's obviously true. And other people are coming to Duisberg's aid, other scientists saying Duisberg is right. We have to discredit him, completely discredit him, because politically, we want to float the cover story in the third world that HIV is what's killing everybody there, when it, obviously it's not killing anybody there, and we want to obscure the real reasons why people are dying. So Duisberg has let loose the Pandora's box and doesn't even know it. Furthermore, he is showing and exposing the fake, intentionally fake science at the National Institutes of Health, Robert Gallo, etc., who have made a bonanza off of this, quote, discovery of HIV, when it's absolutely no science at all. And Duisberg has the greatest reputation among the people who doubt HIV, because he was a primary researcher on cancer in America at the National Cancer Institute, had grants, big-time grants, universally respected as a very acute scientist, but now he's gone off the reservation and we have to take him down, meaning we have to discredit him above all people. We have to say that he's crazy. We have to say that he shouldn't be teaching students at UC Berkeley where he is. We have to cut off his grant money. We have to make him a pariah. We have to have other scientists say, we never really thought he was that good to begin with, and he was always kind of weird and out there and crazy. You know, he teaches at Berkeley. I mean, come on. You know, all of the kind of insinuation, propaganda, lies to make Duisberg overnight, mind you, Gary, overnight, from one of the most esteemed mainstream cancer researchers in America, if not the world, into a nut, a crazy person, a person who is motivated by just some sort of desire for revenge, perhaps, against his former colleagues.
Okay, let me tighten this up a bit. So let me see if I've got you right. I went out to film Peter Duisberg for a documentary I was doing on AIDS. He did not deny, nor did any of the others deny, the existence of the HIV virus. What he said was his research showed that it was from intravenous drug use in heterosexuals, and it was from the lifestyle of a subset of the gay community, about 2%, using amine nitrate and a lot of sexually transmitted diseases, including hepatitis, repeatedly, overuse of antibiotics, etc., and then with hemophiliacs. And he said, and that's all that's continued to have it. And he wrote an article. And because he was, at that time, and had been for the previous 20 years, one of America's top scientists, and certainly the top retrovirologist, he held up a giant book. It must have been 6 inches thick. And he said, Gary, here's all the different studies on retroviruses, and we know them. This is my specialty. And this HIV doesn't do any of the things that this does. And then he went on to publish an article because he was a member of the National Academy of Sciences, he published an article. And initially it was well received. Then something happened. A campaign started. And this was a whisper campaign. It was a quiet campaign. Nobody would debate him. When I went to see him, he had no students. He had the lab. He was a full professor and tenured. He had done nothing wrong. But he said, go down the hall. And down the hall was the dean in all of American institutions of in this area was Dr. Stroman, and there was also Dr. Bailey, both. And they both said, Peter's absolutely right. We've reviewed his literature. We've reviewed his information. We have spent hundreds of hours on this. He is right. But his reputation is being quietly destroyed from behind the scenes. Who's doing
absolutely.
It and how they're doing it, we don't know. Now, that's what I came back with. So I came back saying, my goodness, here's a man who is being destroyed. Who's behind it? You're telling us then that the man who orchestrated that whole smear campaign to destroy him, because he was so popular, he had 240 articles published in peer-reviewed literature, he was a recipient of multiple research grants, he was considered one of the greatest scientists in America. If they could take him out, it would send a message to lesser character, lesser intelligent people, don't tread where he treaded, you'll sink like he did. Is that the message you're giving us?
Yeah, that's the message. And what Medavoy also told me, and I think your listeners would be interested in this, is, you know, how do you do this? Well, there are many methods of destroying somebody's character, whisper campaign, as you say, but also what Medavoy was able to do was influence medical reporters and other reporters, major reporters from mainstream outlets in America, through cultivating the reliable sources of those reporters. Okay? It's not like you talk directly to a reporter, but you begin to, you know, because you're a propaganda operative, who are these medical reporters always relying on, you see? Who are their sources for their stories, especially when it comes to AIDS in this case? Okay, I know who these guys are. And so the campaign begins to cultivate those reliable sources and to move them and influence them and shape them and get them to realize, okay, this is the deal. We're going after Duisberg. He's the enemy. And so when reporters talk to those reliable sources and say, well, what have you got for me? Okay, listen, here's the story. Duisberg is a threat. He is gone off the reservation. He's gone crazy. This work is nothing like his former work.
He is
completely bogus as a scientist and has no reputation left, and you should feel free to destroy him.
We got it. We know who those people are at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease and the National Cancer Institute who were the sources but would never debate Duisberg. We asked them. I asked Robert Gallo and Luc Montagnier. They came on my program, and the moment I asked them a serious question, they hung up on me. They didn't want to answer. So we know the truth of who was behind all this, but now you fill in a picture. You tell us. And I trust your 30-year integrity of having been right on all your topics and stories and ahead of the curve, that you met the man who came to you and said, I was working behind the scenes to destroy this guy's reputation. Because later, twice, Duisberg was brought under official review by the university, and after a lengthy process, they found him had he committed no error at all. But it was too late. His reputation had been trashed. I thank you, John, for sharing this with us, and we look forward to another update on another single topic. But you brought us this story, the man behind the destruction of the best minds in America on HIV/AIDS, and your man who was the character assassination hitman. They exist. John Rapoport and his website, which people can go to, is nomorefakenews.com. All the best, John.
Thank you, Gary, so much.
Let's go immediately to my next guest who is standing by in England, in Cambridge. Melanie Challenger, I gave you her background earlier. She's a British award-winning poet and environmental writer, now working at Cambridge University's Institute of Astronomy. And 6 years ago, she was the artist in residence for the British Antarctic Survey. Her most recent work focused on issues of biocultural diversity and the impact of industrial society upon cultures and ecological endangerment and extinction. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. I would like for you to first give us an overview, if you would, please, about the most recent issue of the journal Science. A group of scientists from New Zealand, Australia, and the UK conceded that Earth was in the middle of a, quote, human-caused massive extinction phase, end quote. Now, we don't know how many species really exist on the planet. Only 1.5 million have ever been cataloged, and there are millions yet to be discovered and identified, I would assume, and most will probably vanish before discovery. And some scientists estimate that 90% of all species have yet to be discovered, and many scientists estimate that 150 species of life go extinct every day, an additional 35 species on average in the rainforest alone. And that means that humans and human activity are gobbling up anywhere between 70 to 200 species every day in order to sustain our global population of 7 billion. So would you give us your insights into this phenomena and what you've seen, from the mountain gorilla to the blue whale to the giant panda?
That's right. People call this the Anthropocene. It was one of your very esteemed, controversial but brilliant scientists, Edward O. Wilson, who's based at Harvard, who coined the term for a human-led extinction. So there've always been natural extinction events, and one of the things that people often say as a counter to any environmental conscience is to say, well, it's natural. This has always happened. Well, that is true. Obviously, this time it's happening knowingly, and this time we know the force, and it's happening very, very quickly. The other thing, as you touched on, is that we don't know the degree of the biodiversity. We can estimate it, but we don't know. It's certainly probably going to be orders of magnitude greater than what we know about at present. And many of the species that may be disappearing may be species that are not as tangible to us in the way that a panda is. And one of the difficulties, I think, for provoking our conscience, the kind of conscience that might change our behavior to a less destructive one or a less rapacious one, is precisely that it's easier for us to look at a blue whale, for instance, which is a species that an animal that I look at a lot in my book on extinction, but they're what we call the poster species, so exciting species, they're very charismatic, and we have they're a mammal, we have a kinship with them that makes it easier for our moral conscience to be pricked. But probably a lot of the species that might disappear are bacteria, for instance, or parasites, parasites that obviously may go extinct because the species that their host may go extinct or may become rarer and so forth. And they're the things where it gets a little grayer about whether we really care if a certain kind of mosquito disappears, a certain bacteria disappears. But obviously they're all part of the diversity of life, and their importance in terms of the entire ecosystem or the biosphere is still very little understood and maybe very considerable.
I appreciate your insight. Thank you. Why is it that you look at people who kind of blink and say, well, why does our civilization simply not care if the extinction of species and older ways of human life are simply collateral damage for progress in doing business in order to live in a post-industrial society isolated from nature. When we know something has gone extinct or is on the verge of extinction, why aren't we coming to some immediate conclusion to do something?
We do care. I mean, a lot of people who, you know, talking about environmental issues necessarily get very frustrated about the delay, and also very distressed about, you know, people who are very involved in the subject who get very distressed about the hopelessness of it and the forces of the countering forces of progress or anthropocentric choices seem to so massively outweigh the sort of limitations and constraints we would need to place on ourselves as societies globally in order to bring carbon emissions, for instance, but also often more pertinently habitat destruction to manageable levels. But I think that it's good to alarm people, it's good to wake people up, but it's also good to recognise how we're operating as a species. Obviously, we can talk about a common human nature, and that is not to deny how individual we all are, but and the variance among people. But there is a common human nature. We're in many ways very similar across multiple societies. And while societies have very different impacts, obviously because of their technological capacity and their sizes, nonetheless, the impulses that drive how we behave are very similar no matter where we are. And so one of the problems with environmental issues is that most of us do have a strong moral conscience insofar as most of us have an innate tendency to care about other people, other species, even a tree, a leaf, and so forth, the sea, the sight of the sea. These things rouse sentiments in us that provide the fuel, if you like, for what can appear to be altruistic actions. But those have many, sometimes visible, sometimes invisible, countering influences or compulsions. So within a person, they may love the sight of a blue whale and feel very anxious about it going extinct. But they may well still buy that TV that they really want that has probably been shipped in some source that may well be damaging to the environment of the blue whale. We've got different desires that are in competition, and it's very, very difficult to weigh up those choices. Extremely difficult now because many of those choices are very invisible to us. And even if we do have all of the available information, we're still going to run up against dilemmas when, for instance, you know, in a very crass way, it might be, a certain kind of drug that we want our child to have to provide it with ongoing life and well-being, coming up against, you know, having to test that on a species and cause the other species suffering. These are immensely difficult moral dilemmas, but it's entirely understandable why we have a crisis. Some of them are a bit more straightforward, i.e. you don't have to get in your car every day, you know, and it would be better if you did switch off that light switch. It doesn't need to be left on in that room. You know, those sorts of things are a little more straightforward, but there are other moral dilemmas where we can sympathise with why, as a species, we, despite many very positive sentiments, continue to be very destructive to our environment and the other life forms with which we share our time here.
Very good insight. I appreciate that. For our regular stations, land-based stations, we're at the end of our program, but I will be continuing to discuss this with Melanie Challenger from Cambridge in the UK. You can continue listening over the telephone or go to progressiveradionetwork.com or our archives. So I thank you for listening. Now, Melanie, when we compare modern industrial societies with indigenous cultures and other nations that have rebelled against the consumerism and technologies that you just mentioned that also distract us from engaging the world, we find modern nations far more sick physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. A poor yet very sustainable country such as Bhutan has a happier, more satisfied, and kind population than any kind that we can find in the developed world. And the same is true for older indigenous cultures that have managed to protect their ways of life from the intrusion of the West. But at the same time, it was social evolution and change that brought about our post-industrial society. And when we look back at our history, it was not always like this. There were always ways of living and connecting with the world and our own heritage that had gone extinct. For example, the satisfaction and wisdom of being self-sufficient and capable of living with nature. So would you please speak about your experiences when you began to investigate the extinction of earlier human ways, even in our earlier industrial period, that at one time connected us with nature? And do you believe our modern civilization is inflicted with a nostalgia for loss for those older days because we are more estranged from nature?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was talking just a moment ago about the sort of sentiments that are the positive sentiments, if you like, the sentiments that give us cause for hope in terms of our relationship with nature. And one of them, I think, is nostalgia. I should clarify that I'm using it in rather a muddy way, and language is muddy anyway, so I don't apologise for that. But to pin it down slightly, what I mean by that is the kind of range of sentiments that encourage us to glance backwards and long for something that is not necessarily entirely disappeared, but on the brink of disappearance, and that often can be a way of life and so forth. It's a glance back, if you like. And I certainly, through doing my research, became very aware of how little I knew as an individual and how much I about the natural world, because of growing up in a very post-industrialized, modern, you know, urban environment. Despite having a great love of nature, I had to go back to the basics. And when I cast my mind back to my mother, my grandmother, even just in those two generations, I could see that there was an erosion of knowledge of nature. And a knowledge of nature is immensely enjoyable. It's enjoyable because it will have aided our survival in a very crass term, but one doesn't have to be so reductive. It just is simply wonderful. It is very enjoyable. It's what drives us to go out onto, to nature events. It's what encourages people to go for walks out and get a lovely holiday home that happens to be, you know, overlooking the lake and so forth. These are all natural impulses because they make us feel good. They're good for our well-being. But there's another reason why that glance back is very important in terms of environmentalism, because of the environmental crisis. Because if you have no baseline knowledge of nature, if that's been lost, if that disconnection has happened, you're just not at a frontline good position to understand how much your environment's been destroyed or how damaged an environment might be. You don't know what's missing, to put it bluntly, and so you're not in a good position to be able to judge what, you know, whether or not your environment, your natural world is okay, or whether what you're receiving is fine. You know, it's okay just to see one butterfly every 2 months or what have you. So that was one thing, just in terms of your baseline awareness of how healthy nature should be. Obviously, go back to the post-industrial Europe and there would have been 90% more of just about everything in nature. We live in a very depleted environment. So that was one area I was very interested in. But the other reason that nostalgia is interesting is because one of the main problems that we have with nature is that it's not, unfortunately, you can't get straightforward explanations or straightforward answers. Nostalgia as a sentiment is great. It's what encourages us to look back and potentially preserve. So in terms of indigenous people and their exceptionally, you know, skilled ways of managing nature that have built up over many generations, that is something that is preserved very carefully through their cultures, and the instinct to keep them is very strong. But obviously one of the other problems that we have with nostalgia is it's when we become aware of something changing, or when we become aware of something being in any way endangered, it can click us over into another mode. It can click us over into destructiveness. And one of the other things that it can do in terms of an industrial society is that it is precisely one of the forces that drives technological change that can actually, ironically, make us more rapacious. So if you look at, say, fishing, it's precisely awareness of, on the part of people who are working in those industries, that the fish stocks are in peril.
Very good insights. Melanie, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your outstanding book, On Extinction, How We Became Estranged from Nature. Melanie Challenger from Oxford University in United Kingdom. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece. Oh, she's coming up in a moment. Look forward to sharing more with you on Sunday night, everyone, on the Talkback Show at 8 o'clock. Have a nice weekend.
You know I can't be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. And don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop thinking of me. Don't make me feel this way. Come on over here and love me. You know what I want you to say. Don't be cruel to who a heart is true. Why should we be apart? I really love you, baby. Cross my heart. Let's walk up to the preacher and let us say I do. Then you'll know you'll have me, and I know that I'll have you. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Oh, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.